You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today not with my co-host, Michael Litchens. Instead, we are here today with another friend of mine, Mr. John Farrell. John Farrell he's a writer, a producer working in Boston. I take it from your accent that Boston is your hometown.
Yeah.
That's what I figured. So, well, I'll get you to do it later. I just want to hear you say park the car in Harvard Yard. That's so important to me to hear you say that. John is the author of The Day Without Yesterday, Lemaître, Einstein and the Birth of Modern Cosmology. You can get that from Basic Books. He's a graduate of Harvard College with a BA in English and American Literature. He's written for Skeptic, Cosmos Magazine, New Scientist, The Wall Street Journal, The Manchester Guardian, Boston Globe, Salon, National Review, Huffington Post, First Things, and The Tablet of London. And he writes a science tech blog for Forbes. And he was a 2010 Templeton Cambridge Journalism Fellow in Science and Religion. And he is, in addition to all of that, a fellow Catholic. Welcome to Connecting the Dots, John Farrell.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, happy to have you. We did a recording a couple of years ago, basically arraigning. There was a question on whether or not Peter Jackson should be arraigned for crimes against humanity.
Yes, and he's still at large.
he's still at large. I think the last thing I heard he was going to do was direct a Doctor Who episode. I don't know if that ever happened or not, but you and I both had strong views about his treatment of The Hobbit. And
yes, and because I'm so loud, both of my children now have very strong views about it as well.
Okay. Yeah. Neither of us were terribly pleased with his treatment of The Hobbit. So
exactly.
But that's water under the bridge. So, how you doing? Now, I understand you're going to be chief science advisor to the Trump administration. Is that just a rumor?
Unfortunately, it's just a rumor. Even if it was true, I wouldn't last long. Steve Bannon would probably have me out of my butt within about, a day and a half.
Another fine Catholic in the Trump administration. But, yeah. I get the feeling that guy is like setting himself up to be the secret grand vizier or something of the entire Trump administration. They got rid of the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence. Those two dummies replaced them with the guy that, comes up with conspiracy theories and alt-right garbage for Breitbart. And that guy is now one of the top people on the National Security Council. It's astonishing to me.
Yes. And apparently already he's asked the full-time National Security Council staff to no longer complete minutes of meetings. In other words, he doesn't want any transparency. So,
holy moly.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. On the other hand, I also read today online that it's likely he won't be approved because apparently it does have to be approved by Congress or the Senate or something. So this may not last long, I hope.
Well, you hope, but then again, you never know what our spine-free, right. Republican-dominated Congress is going to do. I mean, they've rolled over for all this other. Well, rolled over. A lot of this they're enthusiastic about. The crazies are in charge. So I hope that he's not approved. You hope that something like that will happen, but you never know. But anyway, all that is neither here nor there. Thought we might talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done, particularly, you've had a real interest in the interface between interface. Is that a word that's still used, or is that like an 80s word that is stuck in my brain because I'm old?
Well, I'm old too, so I still use it. So I think it's
okay. All right. So, but the interface between science and faith, you're, how should I put it? Not a fan, for example, of the work of the intelligent design guys.
That is correct.
That is correct.
Just on Forbes the past month, I've actually reviewed two books, and I'm doing a third this week, all of them on science and faith. The one I reviewed on the weekend was by Steve Barr, whom you probably know. He writes a lot for First Things, and they finally put together a collection of his best essays and talks in a book called The Believing Scientist. And I was a little surprised because I really got late to the post on Sunday at Forbes. I try to post it in the morning. It's a weekend thing and hope I'll get maybe a couple of thousand views. And because of, you know, personal tasks and all this other stuff, I didn't actually post it till 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon. And I figured, oh, well, no one will even notice. And then like by the next day, it was up to like almost 10,000 views. So
really?
It either irritated or excited somebody out there, and it got passed around. So, so that was a kind of a nice. I think what we're learning about the world of blogging as we go along is it really doesn't matter when you post. You can post at 3 a.m. and if it's a good post, you know, it'll find some traction.
Yeah, it's funny. I was remarking on this the other day. You know, I'll post things and it'll just be like this one off about, you know, I'll make some, you know, quick comment about something or other, and I'll get buried in traffic, and I'm like, really, that's what everybody's interested? Okay. And then I'll write something else, and I'm figuring this is going to get so much hate mail, and it crickets, nobody cares. Yeah. You know. So yeah, that's weird. So well, talk about the Barr book a little bit.
It's very good. It's basically he's been writing for First Things, I think, at least since the mid-1990s, although perhaps even earlier. And, of course, he's written a very famous book, which I am also going to mention because I basically stacked up all my kind of faith and science books for us to kind of refer to. He wrote a book called Modern Physics and Ancient Faith about 14 years ago. And a lot of us fans were hoping, you know, when is he going to write the next one? And so this was really nice that they put this together. And if you read First Things regularly, then you'll know or recognize or remember several of the essays in there. And a couple that stand out was his famous debate with Cardinal Schoenborn about the role of chance in evolution, which this was, you know, way back in 2005 in the aftermath of the Dover trial when the intelligent design thing was when that whole kind of debacle happened. Mm-hmm. And Cardinal Schoenborn had got himself into a little bit of trouble by publishing an editorial in the New York Times that seemed to suggest that science was wrong. Not that, oh, you know, Darwinists are overstepping the bounds philosophically. I think he meant to do that, but what he ended up doing was actually saying that, you know, the science is not correct. And that got a lot of scientists, including some Catholic scientists, a little upset. And they responded. And I think this essay in First Things that Steve Barr wrote was an outgrowth of some of that. And Cardinal Schoenborn also wrote a separate essay. But that's one of the kind of more familiar essays in the book. And there are also book reviews. There's two fairly tough book reviews.
John, can I ask a favor?
Sure.
Could you move your mic away from your mouth just a little bit? Because we're getting a lot of...
Sure. I'll turn it a little bit. Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
Good. Okay. It also includes the book also includes two pretty tough reviews of books by Richard Dawkins. And I quoted a fairly large passage in my Forbes review where he really takes Dawkins to task for just missing some really basic you know, scientific facts.
Right.
So it's exciting that that book is out, and I hope it does well.
The ID thing, I watch that. I go to a Dominican parish, and the Dominicans not keen on ID.
Oh, no, not at all.
because it turns out to do real damage to Thomism. in a lot of ways. It's not a Thomistic approach at all. And I happen to live in the town that is where the Discovery Institute is located. I was in my hometown of Seattle, and the Discovery Institute has been like the big promoters of ID.
Exactly.
And so we get the, I've seen arguments go on, you know, between not the Dominicans at my parish. I think they're just too busy doing other things, but I've watched the Dominicans arguing with the ID guys. Can you, for people who are not familiar with, I think a lot of people just think that intelligent design arguments are the same thing that Thomas is making. Can you
not at all
talk about the difference?
Sure. Basically the difference, is well, if this was a sports game, I'd be saying the Thomists are Catholic and the intelligent designers are Protestant. but it really does boil down to intelligent design is basically a kind of a descendant of the natural theology of William Paley, who was the famous British naturalist, and he wrote a book about I don't remember the title, but it was a very famous book about the design in nature. And his famous example was, you know, well, what if you walked through the woods one day and you stumbled upon a watch, you know, by its intricacy and complexity, you'd assume that obviously someone designed this. It wasn't just an accident. And the intelligent design folks have basically adopted that. They're trying to use modern science to make the same case. And it's basically a negative argument that the science that we have, Darwinian evolution, can't explain adequately the origin of species and how life has evolved over, you know, millions and millions of years. And scientists have been saying, of course, it can't.
Okay, well, we will return to this when we get back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with John Farrell. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
The Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with John Farrell, and we're talking about, you were talking before the break about the distinction between intelligent design theory and how a Thomist looks at things like evolution and so forth.
Yes, and basically intelligent design is mostly resistant to the aspects of evolution that are the most random, the most stochastic and unpredictable.
Used a big word there, stochastic.
Oh, and that means random. It means, you know, it can't be predicted. It just, you know, it happens, but there's no way to predict it or to model it in a way like, say, physicists would model the trajectory of something, you know, through space using Newton. So okay. That's basically what it meant is random. Okay. Random. Right. And so in the resistance to that, they're trying to argue that Darwinian evolution can't be good enough. There has to be more directly design elements that we can find in nature. And they actually never suggest any that could be looked at by other scientists in a kind of a peer review sense. And in contrast, the Thomists and the Dominicans, of course, going back to Thomas and actually even earlier, have always believed in what, you know, they refer to as secondary causes. In other words, that God is the ultimate creator, but he communicates to the world its own ability to cause things.
Right.
And so it's not a problem to accept that evolution seems to proceed by these two different tracks. There's random variation from generation to generation, and then natural selection acts upon, you know, the right. ones that are the most likely to survive or get rid of the ones who are right. most likely not to survive. So that just doesn't present a philosophical problem to Dominicans. And so that's kind of I think Catholics, especially American Catholics, have kind of absorbed more of that kind of Protestant natural theology that came with Paley. The interesting thing is, Darwin read Paley before he came up with evolution, and he was a big fan. And I think it was the late Father Edward Oakes who suggested, if Darwin had been a Catholic, he wouldn't have lost his faith. You probably know that he lost one of his precious children when she was only 10. To a horrible disease, and it really scarred him. And I think, as even-handed as he was, he never came out and said he was an atheist, but I could tell he struggled with what he thought was the chaotic natural evil in the world, and he found it hard to reconcile with that kind of, Paleian God that he grew up with.
Right.
So that kind of illustrates, I think, the problem with adopting intelligent design. Now, from a philosophical perspective, it's fine to, we all look out sometime at a gorgeous day and say, God, isn't this wonderful? I'm so glad God designed the world this way. But we're talking philosophically. We're not insisting that we can go in a lab and prove it, which is kind of the mistake that the intelligent design movement makes.
Yeah. I think the thing that really kind of clicked in my brain that made sense of the distinction between ID and the way a Thomist look, because a Thomist does make an argument from design.
Yes.
But what's interesting is, as a friend of mine pointed out, a guy named Michael Flynn, science fiction writer, actually.
Oh, yeah, I know Mike, yeah.
Oh, you know Mike Flynn, okay.
Yeah, we've been on a few panels together at Boston.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, I love the guy. He's just a great writer.
Very dry
sense of humor. He wrote, by the way, just putting a plug in here for this, he wrote a series one time on his blog called the TOF Spot that you can go find on Blogspot. He did this series on how we got from geocentrism to heliocentrism.
Oh, yes. The great Ptolemaic smackdown, I think, is what he called it.
The great Ptolemaic smackdown and down a dirty mud wrestle. And it is so fun. It is just a terrific piece of science history. So if you're just looking for just a writer that will crack you up, that is the guy for you. But anyway, he in talking about the distinction between ID and Thomism, he says that what ID does, like Paley did, was it argues from exceptions to the rules. Here's this thing you can't explain. A watch, a complicated cell. You can't explain this. Therefore, God.
Right.
And the problem with that argument, called the God of the Gaps argument, of course, is the moment you can explain it is the moment that your faith in God goes on the rocks, if that's all you've got.
Exactly.
500 years ago, somebody could have said, oh, yeah, if there's no God, then explain lightning. Well, then someone comes along and explains lightning. If there's no God, explain disease. Your faith is in ruins. And what Thomas does is he doesn't argue. He never argues from exceptions to the rules. He never argues from miracles, for example, that there must be a God. What he argues from is the rules. Why are there rules? Why is there anything? And so he begins at the same place where the sciences themselves begin. The sciences have to begin with, look, there are understandable, intelligible rules. If there aren't, then there's no point doing science, because that's what we're doing when we're doing science, is trying to understand the rules.
Exactly.
And that's how Thomas proceeds. And so it's through that he argues for the existence, the common, as he always does, he argues from common sense, the existence of design. But it's always because there are rules, not because there are exceptions to the rules.
Right, exactly.
And by the way, as Catholics, you and I can both grant that there are exceptions to the rules, because we're supernaturalists, we believe in the miraculous, but we don't make them a cornerstone of an argument for the existence of God.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well put.
Yep. So anyway, what else were we going to talk? Oh, that was the other thing. Just something. You wrote a book on Monsignor Georges Lemaître. He was a Belgian, right?
He was Belgian, yes. Belgian born and bred.
Talk a little bit about your book, The Day Without Yesterday.
It's basically a science bio of his life, but also his interactions with Einstein, because, you know, he really he took Einstein's work and applied it across the cosmos. There had been very few people up to the time, and it's just over 100 years now that ago that Einstein developed his general theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. And Lemaître, who was fairly young and a really bright mathematician, looked at the theory and realized that, wow, that you can do some really cool stuff with this if we look at the universe as a whole. And Einstein, of course, had kind of done some, you know, what he called cosmological considerations himself, but he really kind of had adopted and grew up with the kind of Newtonian static view of the universe from the 19th century, which was basically like the universe has always been here, always will be, and it's kind of like a beautiful oil painting. And even though his own field equations were suggesting that not really, it's got to be, it can't be static. So he kind of put in what he called a fudge factor to kind of balance the equation so that nothing would move. And not just Lemaître, actually, there was a famous Russian mathematician. The poor guy died before he could actually make his mark, who first took Einstein's equations and published papers saying, hey, look, we could have like a yo-yo universe that goes in and out. We can have one that expands forever. We can have one that just collapses. And he passed away in 1925, which was right around the time when Lemaître was kind of doing the same thing. The real difference with Lemaître, though, that really makes him stand out is that he also started looking for evidence, which is to say he kind of came over to the U.S. He went to the U.K., came to the U.S., met with, you know, the few astronomers there were at the time when they were just starting to take measurements of redshifts, I should say, of the galaxies, which were all showing, suggesting that they were moving away from us. Any direction you looked in space. Now, they didn't have a huge sample. They probably had like 20 to 25 total, but that was enough for Lemaître to kind of plot a little graph and say, hey, look, the further away they are, the faster they're moving. And this was, of course, what Hubble would be most known for when he came along with his kind of superior telescopes. But in 1927, Lemaître, you know, wrote all this out and was pretty much ignored for a couple of years until Hubble. And when I say ignored, not only because they didn't read the paper, but because Einstein really didn't want to hear it. He was at the time he was getting locked into big debates about quantum physics, and he'd kind of let relativity go. And along comes this kind of precocious priest and says, you know, the universe is really should, you know, it's expanding. And he was like, that's nuts. Your math is great, but your physical intuition is terrible. But by the time Hubble published his findings, Lemaître's mentor in the UK, Arthur Stanley Eddington, and the Dutch astronomer Willem de Sitter, they kind of got behind him and said, yeah, this seems to be the right solution to what we're seeing because we can no longer maintain that the universe isn't dynamic. And then even Einstein came around. So there and of course, because he was a priest, there was some pushback. There was some suspicion. When he first, and I should say, he didn't think of the Big Bang theory until after Einstein, you know, decided he was cool with the idea of an expanding universe. It was Lemaître who again went back to the data, Hubble's new data, and then looking at the equations, he said, "You know what? The idea initially he had thought, well, we could start with Einstein's static universe, and then from there it'll launch into an expansion phase forever."
We're up against a break, but we will continue when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with John Farrell. And we'll be back talking about Monsieur Georges Lemaître and the Big Bang right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with John Farrell. And we're talking about his book, The Day Without Yesterday. It's a biography of Monsignor Georges Lemaître, who is the Belgian physicist who came up with the Big Bang Theory.
That's right, version 1.0.
Yeah, version 1.0. That's right.
So we were, yeah. We were
for this.
He did, yeah, yes. And when he finally, he actually wrote, it was a fairly short letter to Nature saying that, now that I think about it, you know, the expansion model suggests that we really have to wind it back to some kind of a beginning point. And this did not meet with a great deal of approval. And even like Arthur Stanley Edderton, who was, I think he was a Quaker, you know, so he was religious. He found the idea just like, ugh. I can't stand the idea of a beginning. And Einstein didn't like it either. Now, it's easy to kind of overdo some of the philosophical resistance to the idea. The fact is, too, that he didn't really have any evidence to support the idea. I mean, what he needed was, and what he thought of at the time, was that perhaps cosmic rays were kind of leftover from the initial explosion, if you will, even though that's kind of a misleading term, because the Big Bang wasn't the explosion of matter into space. It was the explosion of everything into existence, including space. But anyway, so he and for all sorts of reasons, World War II being a big one, he kind of had to drop out of the research, just to save his life. He wasn't, once the Germans took over Belgium, you know, he wasn't going anywhere. And then, of course, everybody got caught up in the war effort, you know, making the bomb, quantum physics. So cosmology kind of went into the background for a couple of decades until the 40s when George Gamow, the flamboyant Ukrainian physicist, kind of picked up where Lemaître left off. And he was actually coming at it from a different perspective. He was wondering, you know, how could the universe have made all the kind of elements that make us, you know, iron, steel, you know, nickel, all the kind of heavier elements that, you know, go into making planets like Earth, rather than just, you know, boring hydrogen and helium, which is all you would have if you just went back to the beginning. So he and his students kind of worked on what they called a hot Big Bang theory. And then finally, as you know, the evidence, the best evidence didn't come until 1965, and that was a year before Lemaître died. He fortunately did live to see it, though, because the scientists published their findings, basically what they did was they discovered the leftover radiation from the beginning, which Gamow and several others predicted would be measurable, like just a few degrees above absolute zero. And of course, those guys win the Nobel Prize and Lemaître gets to die in a hospital and gets forgotten about. You know, and not just him. I mean, lots of people involved in it were kind of overlooked. And there was some deep resentment and bitterness about that when the Nobel Prize went to the guys who kind of accidentally discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation. But
yeah, they were like working for Bell Labs. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Why the hell can't we get rid of this low hum of radiation that's screwing up our measurements?
It's everywhere in the universe.
Exactly.
Well, you know, what fascinates me, one of the great ironies of all of this, you were saying a little bit ago that particularly a lot of American Catholics have really picked up on a lot of Protestant thinking, among other things, in their arguments for the existence of God and so forth. And so they picked up ID arguments, and they picked up this idea somehow or other that evolution is a threat. It is a threat to our faith, and it has to be argued away. And so you get a lot of Catholics who are very interested in these arguments against scientific evidence, which is colossal. I mean, the evidence for evolution is overwhelming. It's huge. But the irony is that those same people, because they feel threatened by the sciences, and they talk about evolution, then the pushback comes from atheists who say there's always been a war between science and religion, and the Catholic Church is the big enemy of the sciences, and et cetera, et cetera. So you get that rhetoric coming out of the, you know, the kind of the 4chan atheist community.
Right.
And then what you get is pushback from Catholics who point to one scientist after another who was a Catholic. So Copernicus and who else, or religious in some way. So, you know, Copernicus or Louis Pasteur. And one of the people that they'll point to is Monsignor Georges Lemaître, the guy that, you know, came up with the Big Bang Theory. So that proves that Catholics don't hate the sciences. Well, the great irony, of course, is that all Lemaître did was expand evolutionary theory to a cosmic scale. So instead of just looking at life on Earth, it's, you know, he basically said that evolution is the explanatory paradigm for everything.
Going back to the beginning.
Right, going back to the beginning, the whole universe. And the people who were so upset about evolution, so bent on you're destroying the theory of evolution as a threat to the Christian faith, are often the same people who will appeal with pride to somebody like Georges Lemaître or to Gregor Mendel. And what did Gregor Mendel discover? Well, he discovered the engine biological evolution on Earth, you know, because that's what genetic theory is. And so it's a great irony that a lot of times the people who are so concerned about defeating evolution as a threat to the faith are also busy appealing to two of the most important figures in the science of cosmic evolution and also in the science of biological evolution.
Exactly, yes. And I think, and of course, it isn't helped by some of the more vociferous atheists who – Richard Dawkins is famous for saying that, you know, evolution for him made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Although I imagine you could have found lots of them like living through the Black Death in the Middle Ages.
My response to Dawkins is, well, okay, if your intellect is sufficiently shallow, I guess, you know. But come on, you know, it's not an all-explaining theory of everything.
Exactly.
Because, you know, again, why are there rules? Why is there anything? You're leaving a huge, important step out right at the beginning, Dick. So anyway, what else have you been writing about recently? I don't know if you've talked about I'm one of these people that doesn't understand climate science at all because I'm not a climate scientist. And have you covered this at all? Because I don't understand it.
I haven't really, only because, you know, I have my hands full as it is, just between like evolution and cosmology. I do find it interesting, and I don't see any reason to doubt it, having said that, especially when like the Department of Defense is starting to factor into their plans for naval bases the fact that the sea levels are rising. I figure, well, you know, if the guys in the military are worried about climate change, that's, you know, that's probably a good reason too, even if you're not diving into all of the science.
So it's not a Chinese conspiracy then?
Right, exactly. You know, okay. Unless the Chinese have already taken over the Department of Defense, in which case, you know, that would make sense.
Well, you know, one of the things that strikes me, we saw a bit of it in the discussion a minute ago about Georges Lemaître, is that science is done by people, and people have their own weird prejudices and agendas. And so, one of the fears with Lemaître's theory was it sounded too suspiciously like you-know-who. Exactly. You know, the whole prospect that the universe had a beginning, sounded, you know, and so you got this pushback, not really on the basis of any evidence, but just because it sounded like you know who.
And what's interesting, because I think you hit on something when you were talking about, you know, the irony of rejecting biological evolution but embracing cosmic evolution. There is a strain of evangelical Christianity that rejects the Big Bang, and I wonder if that's the reason why. I mean, now, I haven't studied it that much, only because, you know, I don't really care to. There's only so many hours in the day. But perhaps there's a strain there of what you were tapping into, which is they realize that, hey, wait, you know, the Big Bang is evolution as well, and we reject it. So let's not accept the Big Bang theory either, even though from another point of view, you can look at the Big Bang Theory as kind of pointing towards, you know, not the moment of creation, obviously, but, you know, T equals zero or T equals one for our universe. So that's kind of a fascinating thread.
Well, yeah. And it is very interesting that, you know, when Thomas talks about creation, he's working with Aristotle, and Aristotle takes for granted an eternal universe. And the only reason Thomas doesn't go with Aristotle is because he has Revelation. And right. Revelation says there's a beginning. And so Thomas says, well, then there's a beginning. You know, God knows better than Aristotle. But what's interesting is that for Thomas, as far as he's concerned, the universe could be eternal, and it wouldn't at all get rid of the idea of a creator.
Exactly.
That a creator could hold an eternal universe in being just as easily as he could hold a universe that has a beginning in time.
Exactly.
Well, we'll continue that line of thought when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with John Farrell, and we'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with John Farrell. Thought we'd take the last segment and I just want to pick your brain. I'm a Catholic, and I want to know more about science and faith. What should I read?
Well, since we were a great start would be to start with the Dominicans, since we were talking about them and ID. And it just so happens a new book just came out. It's actually a website that was started by Father Nicanor Austriaco. He's a biologist and a Dominican. So he's got his degree in Thomistic philosophy, and he teaches at Providence. And he and three other Dominicans, James Brent, Thomas Davenport, and John Baptist, put together a website called ThomisticEvolution.org. And it basically, what they wanted to do, which I think is really cool, is they wanted to provide some pastoral support for all these kind of questions about science and faith. So they built this website with the help of Biologos and Templeton. And basically what they have is, you know, that kind of scholastic tradition of disputed questions. So they'll literally ask a question like, you know, how do we square evolution with creation? What is faith? Faith and reason. Modern biblical exegesis of the creation accounts. The web of evidence for evolution. What should I think about Adam and Eve from an historical perspective? What should we think about original sin, you know, in light of evolution? And you can read them all in book form, which just came out from Clooney. That's the name of the press. Or you can go to the website and just print out PDFs of each one. But I think their hope was that these would be the kind of things that a priest could, you know, slip into the parish bulletin if it was an issue that was, you know, of interest to the parish, which I think is really needed because as much as at a high level, you know, the Vatican and has talked about religion and science and faith and science in very accommodating terms, I don't think it's often gotten down to the pastoral level, especially in the U.S., where you still get the sense that there's conflict going on and certain things that are simply irreconcilable. So I think this book and that website, again, it's just, you could just Google Thomistic Evolution and you'll find it. It's a great resource and also an interesting book. which brings me to my second book. This is a little older and a little bit more academic, but it's called Faith, Reason, and the Natural Sciences, the challenge of the natural sciences in the work of theologians. And this is by a priest I've met a couple of times, Father Giuseppe Tanzelliniti, who teaches at the University of Santa Croce in Rome. He's an astronomer and a theologian. And what I like about him is, without being an alarmist, he worries that, and this goes back to that famous letter Pope John Paul wrote to the head of the Vatican Observatory in 1988, that theologians really need to think more about integrating science into theology at the risk of making the faith seem not out of touch, but irrelevant on a lot of issues. And he basically writes, "I'm convinced that without a sufficient assimilation of scientific knowledge in the work of theologians, theology could run the risk of engaging only in kind of defending what a given age has once understood about the doctrinal content of the faith, but not, you know, the challenges that are coming." And this is, you know, this is not some kind of blind follower of Teilhard. I mean, Father Tanzelliniti is a priest of Opus Dei. He's very, you know, doctrinally correct, very conservative, but he's a scientist and he gets the fact that, you know, I think at some levels, Catholic theologians have neglected that kind of task. So that's a very good book. And of course, I've already mentioned Steve Barr's Modern Physics and Ancient Faith, which is definitely worth getting, and his new book, The Believing Scientist.
One of the things that I've had some conversations about with various people who are involved in like Catholic apologetics, and they keep their finger on the pulse of the sciences. And one of the things that they're saying is a number of theologians are starting to say, look, don't bet the farm on a single pair of ancestors for the entire human race. That the science is not pointing that way. What am I looking at? What's the
polygenism?
Polygenism.
Monogenism. Yes.
Monogenism. Yeah. That's, you know, that's gonna sooner or later that's gonna be coming up. And we've got to, you know, we're gonna have to revisit our tradition, see what the church has actually said. I've actually done it a bit, and the church came this close, but not all the way to committing to monogenism.
Yes, that was Pope Pius XII's encyclical.
Right.
But he was very careful, though. I mean, he just said
he was.
Yeah. It's in no way apparent, he said, how we can reconcile the idea that we come from more than two humans with, you know, scripture.
Right.
And it's a good thing he said that.
Right. Yeah. And which is true enough. But that's not the same as saying you cannot possibly reconcile the science with the data of revelation. He's just he's doing what, you know, what a circumspect theologian is supposed to do, and say, I don't see this, but I don't know everything either, you know.
Yes. But that's one of those encyclicals. You can, you know, they're very traditional Catholics will hit you over the head with that encyclical, saying that no, but you know, you can't believe that it's possible that there were other people at the same time as Adam and Eve. And, you know, again, they're kind of workarounds, but I think that's one area where some more pastoral guidance would be really helpful, because if they want to read the encyclical literally, they kind of do, and then they hit you over the head with it.
Yeah.
And in a sense, you can't blame them, because I think there hasn't been a lot of elucidation from the top down.
Right.
But I'm hoping that'll kind of change.
Well, and that's typical for the Catholic Church. I mean, you know, one of my favorite moments in recent church history was when L'Osservatore Romano came out with this statement saying, this is like, I don't know, 5 years ago, they came out with a statement saying, you know, the Beatles were pretty good. It's like, well, thank you for, you know, delivering yourself of that magisterial verdict after 50 years, you know. But that's typical for the church. You know, the church will ruminate for a century or two and then finally go, yeah, it appears that polygenism is compatible with the faith. We've been thinking about it slowly.
Right. Now, what's kind of interesting and ironic about it is that when you talk to a scientist, a biologist, about monogenism, for him, that means we came from a population of people, and polygenism means several different populations popped up all over the world elsewhere. Whereas a Catholic hears Pelagianism and he just thinks there were more than two people. So,
interesting.
Yes. And it's something you have to be kind of keep that in mind, because the scientific monogenism is exactly what scientists, you know, have basically said, yeah, this is it. Because there used to be debate about whether humans, and this, you know, this really, this goes back to what was a big concern of the popes, which was the unity of the human race. And if the idea was that, for example, Africans came from one population and Europeans literally came from another population that had no connection, well, there's, you know, that's fodder for racism.
Right.
And he wanted to avoid that. So in a sense, I think if he were alive now, he'd be like, this is awesome. You know, genetically, we're looking back all the way to one population that came out of Africa 60,000 years ago. And it's a done deal. We're all descended from that group. So in that sense, the science, I think, is actually not only encouraging, it's kind of like inspiring.
Well, you know, it's his point is well taken, especially after the horrors that we saw unleashed in the 20th century.
Yes.
Precisely coming from this crackpot racial theory, you know, which we're not out of the woods, you know.
Oh, I know.
we're seeing it rear its ugly head again, you know, with the alt-right right here in the United States.
Yeah.
And this whole notion that there, you know, there are really different species of human or subspecies of human, and we can treat those subspecies as subhuman. The Pope was very right to be afraid of it.
Yes.
So yeah. Yeah. Well, golly, we got a couple of minutes left. Other books you want to recommend?
Oh, very quickly. This is a new book, which I reviewed, Stacy Trisankos' book, Particles of Faith, which is really, it's different in the sense that it's semi-autobiographical. She talks about her career as a scientist before converting to Catholicism, and she's got a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And so I would recommend that perhaps as a beginning book if you're new to the whole genre, because it's really like sitting down and having a chat with someone.
Okay.
So whereas the other books I've been talking about, I geek out about them, but they are a bit academic.
Okay. She's very good, by the way.
Yes, she's excellent.
Yeah, she's been a blogger for a good long while too. So you can find her online. How's her last name spelled? Trasancos?
COS, that's right. Trasancos, okay. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Any other, we're almost out of time here. We got maybe a minute or two left. Any other books you want to recommend?
One book I would recommend, it's by the late Archbishop Joseph Szynski. I'll spell that. Szynski. He was very close to Pope John Paul, and he was often attended a lot of the kind of summer meetings at Castel Gandolfo that were, you know, debates and discussions with scientists. And he wrote a book called God and Evolution, Fundamental Questions of Christian Evolutionism. And it's outstanding. If you wanted to start with something that would point you into all sorts of other sources for further reading, I would highly recommend that book.
And right.
That came out relatively recently, and that's easy to find.
Okay. Well, I think we're just about out of time here. I want to thank you so much, John Farrell. Where can people find your work?
Well, if you go to Forbes, you can just put my name in.
Okay.
And also, the book is on Amazon. It's very easy to find, The Day Without
Fantastic.
Yesterday.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, John. You've been listening
to here.
John. Oh, a pleasure. Been listening to John Farrell. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.